Well, hi everyone, and welcome to, what is this called? Designers for Learning on edtechtalk.com. Today is April 14th, and at very short notice, I was very, very happy to get our guest today, Trey Martindale. Trey is an associate professor at the University of Memphis in their Instructional Design and Technology program. And just to give a brief introduction to Trey, the reason I asked him to come on is he is part of an instructional design consultancy that is run by students, and so it very much fits in with the theme of our webcast here, which has to do with applied learning and service learning and experiential learning, and kind of name your category that you like to call it. So Trey, do you want to just tell us, to kind of kick things off, what's the story behind the consultancy? Where did it come from, and why did you develop it?
Thanks for having me. Good to see you. We have this thing here called the IDT Studio, and IDT is just, we always call it, that's our program, Instructional Design and Technology. So the studio is actually a physical place, and the way it came about is we, in our College of Education building, when the recovery money was coming around, and we got a little bit of that when the stimulus package was passed around 2008, I suppose, our provost had a little bit of extra funds, and he basically said, I know there are some innovative things going on in this university, and I have identified a few of them that I like, and I want to ask you to compete for a little bit of funds to do something neat within your programs. And so we've got some really enterprising faculty here, Michael Grant, Cliff Mims, Deborah Lowther, all on our faculty here. We put forward a proposal that said basically we want to do something with a space and something for our students to give them some real-world experience. And we called it the IDT Studio. And so the provost and our dean said, okay, here's a little bit of funds for you to basically take an old junky part of our building and clean it up and make it look nice and do some special things with equipment and so forth and make it a real show place within our building and also give you a chance to enhance your program with students doing some hands-on projects. And so I think I can maybe share a link with you later that has some pictures and things like that.
Yeah, that'd be kind great.
Of maybe even before and after, which might be interesting for people to see. And it's funny, the physical stuff and the technology and things like that are not really what we're about, but it's what gets people's attention.
Right.
You know, I mean, we get a lot of tourists coming through here and a lot of faculty coming and saying, what's going on? And so, you know, we use that to our benefit to say, here are some neat things you can do within your courses or with any kind of instructional project that you have going. But by the way, we're going to slip in instructional design. You know, it's kind of like the vitamins that come in with the donuts, if right. you will. So it gives us a chance to bring people in and then also talk about instructional design, what it means to have clear objectives and have clear instruction going on and authentic assessment and things like that. So what was your question?
No, this is good. And it's actually, this is not the answer I thought I was going to get. It's like you said, the chicken or the egg, you know, which do you have the idea or, you know, and then like you actually had the space, the funds, and then you had to kind of come up with the concept. And
that's right. We were kind of striking while the iron was hot.
Yeah.
That's right. We had an opportunity in front of us and we said we were going to take it. And we already had something smaller like this in place. We called it our AIM lab, our Advanced Instructional Media Lab. And it was a place where mostly students would come to work on their projects together, and it was kind of our communal lounge, if you will, for our IDT program. And we had some technology, you know, some computers and special software and things like that, but nothing on the scale of what we have now, and nothing really involving outside clients, which has been new in the last 3 years.
And that's definitely something I'd like to talk about. So a lot of the people we've spoken with in the series in prior webcasts have talked about some, you know, project-based things that they're doing. And a lot of times they're hypothetical cases, and then you're trying to design either in teams or whatever. But bringing in that element of having a real-life client, can you kind of talk through what does that mean to your students and how does that kind of raise the bar, or does it raise the bar for the students that are working on the projects?
Well, I definitely think it does. And we've had – we have a capstone course in our master's program where the students were already working with real clients. And so they were working in instructional design teams, and we actually have a process where we would solicit requests from companies here in the Memphis area usually that needed something done, you know, a special instructional website or a print-based program or something like that. And these teams of students in the class would then take on that project. And they would do a showcase at the end. And that still goes on. In fact, the showcase is next week where the students are doing that kind of presentation of their project. So really this is just taking that a little bit farther. With the studio, we basically put forth the idea. We've done a little bit of marketing around the university, and I'm kind of a networking person, and so we have a local chapter of ASTD, American mm-hmm. Society of Training and Development. We have a Memphis chapter here, and I also run a group that I call eLearn Memphis, which is basically a monthly in-person meeting where I invite someone from the community who's doing e-learning, doing some kind of training initiative. Usually they're an instructional designer or a training leader or something like that. They come in and do a show and tell and maybe talk about a project or talk about a new software tool or something like that. Really, it's a chance to network. You know, we have the presentation as a reason to get together and for people to talk, and lots of folks get internships and jobs and things like that through that community. And we're in Memphis, which is a pretty good-sized city, and we have FedEx here and AutoZone and St. Jude's Children's Hospital and a big healthcare community. So there actually are quite a few e-learning companies here and people doing e-learning kinds of stuff. So anyway, that's been the crowd that we're drawing from.
And so the folks I've been speaking with previously who are doing this really touched on that. What you've mentioned here is this need to reach out, and that's quite a task in and of itself for the person facilitating an experience like this, that you need the clients. And a lot of times people don't know what instructional design is when you go out and you try to explain what we do, and then it's, you know, trying to find a project that matches what your students are capable and ready to handle, and something that can be completed, as you're saying, within a 16-week semester. So do you find it, you can kind of talk through that process, like when you identify someone either as a new person to work with or someone you've worked with in the past, how do you kind of go through that scoping process of seeing what they have to do and trying to explain what you're able to do, again, within the confines of a 16-week semester?
Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, you're right on there in the sense that it's kind of an instructional project to explain what we do,
explain
our field, and then we can kind of get around to the point of, and here are some of your needs that you may not know are instructional needs, and here's how we can help you with those kind of things. So it's kind of educating the potential client along the way.
Right. So what are some of the buzzwords? What are some of the things? Because I'm kind of at that stage myself. I'm talking to some nonprofits locally here in Chicago, kind of trying to do a lot of the stuff you're talking about. And sometimes it's referred to as human resources, training and development. And then as soon as you say some of those words, it's like, oh, okay. Or if you're working with a nonprofit, you're talking about maybe onboarding their volunteers or something like that. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the buzzwords that have worked for me. What are some of the things that you've hit upon?
Well, it's funny, you know, that I think the word instruction is kind of falling out of favor in general. And I think that's happening in our field and also in the community at large. And, you know, lots of groups call themselves learning and development. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a personal axe to grind. I hear people calling themselves learning designers, which, you know, well, learning is kind of an outcome, but it's, you can't really design learning.
Design learning, right.
It's internal to the person. And yet it's catchy. And so, you know, mm-hmm. are you gonna fight that tidal wave or go with it? You know,
we're
still instructional design at this point. But in fact, I noticed at the University of Georgia they changed the name of their program to Learning, Design and Technology.
Oh, so no instruction,
no instruction
at all.
Yeah. So they didn't go all the way to learning design. They're learning, design and technology.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And don't even get us started on technology, because that's a whole thing too, right? what are you talking about?
And it's funny, we kind of use the word technology. It kind of has a bit of a halo around it for us in our immediate department, because it has technology in it. Although sometimes people will come and say, hey, can you fix my printer? You
know, exactly.
You've got technology in your name. And people don't think about the process. When they hear technology, they think hardware and software.
And actually, and I'm kind of keep going down the same theme here. I have students this semester going out in a class of advanced students, as you mentioned, with your capstone project. And actually, this was a huge hurdle for them, is to go out and sell their wares and tell people what they were doing. And to your your point, it's are you selling design services or development? So is what it kind of, there was kind of a fork in the road, and the development would be more, you know, can you use Articulate to create a little thing for me, a little module for me? And you know, they are obviously coming from more of a, you know, theory based, you know, like we've got some good ideas here on how you could actually design things, and so they're, you know, trying to push them down a different path. And so do you find that as well, that you are kind of having a fork in the road between the design piece as well as then the development piece?
I think it does fork, and then we try to do this. We try to bring it back together, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Most of the requests that we've gotten through the studio have been development work, because that's easier, I think, for particularly university faculty that are here to kind of get their hands around. They think, okay, I went to a seminar about screencasts, and so I want you to make me a screencast.
Yes.
How to make screencasts.
We had that exact effect. A student was trying to help someone transition a lot of face-to-face things into an online environment. And so she had some, you know, pretty robust ideas, and the person said, I learned about SlideShare. Can't we just put all our PowerPoints up on SlideShare, and then we'll be done? And so she, as you're saying, she had to kind of bring the forks back to one highway, I guess.
We had one of the most interesting projects that's come out of the studio so far was really a design project. And there's another university that's not too far from us that was about to initiate a bunch of new online courses. And their faculty were going to be developing these courses. And these were folks from the liberal arts, from lots of different fields. They were from theater, from religion, from English, from chemistry, lots of different areas. And no one had taught an online course before or developed an online course before. And as is common at universities, the administration offered them a stipend. They said, hey, we'll give you, I don't know what it was, like $3,000 or $4,000 and maybe a laptop computer, and then there's your carrot to go and develop this course. And you know, they had a request for proposals and so forth, and so these folks were chosen. But they didn't really have the instructional design support. And so through a kind of a personal connection, they found out about the studio, and they said to us, hey, do you do this kind of thing? And I said, well, absolutely we do. And so I pitched it to them as in, we are instructional design coaches. We're going to coach you. And that's actually a really good metaphor, because if you think about what a coach does for you, you know, if you're an athlete, you know, the coach looks at your performance. They don't do your sport for you. You know, they look at what you're doing. They give you evaluative feedback. They cheer you on. They maybe bring resources to you that you didn't know about. And then you actually do the event while they're coaching you on. And so that's what we do.
That is actually excellent. My students also were facing, especially being students and going in, the whole extra set of hands that where they were said, oh, okay, yeah, we've been trying to migrate a bunch of junk online. Can you sit there at a computer and do some data entry or whatever it might be? But to your point, consider if they had approached the relationship saying, I'm really more of a coach, I'm really more a different, I'm not really an extra set of hands just to help you get something accomplished that off your checklist of things to do.
Right. And it's kind of a tricky issue working with faculty, which we've actually done a lot of. We've had some outside clients, like we've worked with a publisher. We did some work for IBM. So we've had a few sort of corporate clients, but most of ours have been university faculty. And it's tricky because, at least in the U.S., we're under this assumption that people that are university faculty are instructional experts, when in fact, it's very common that the typical professor has had no training in instruction whatsoever. That person is a content expert. They're an expert in, you know, in biochemistry, or they're an expert in political science, or the history of the United States up to 1877, you know, whatever it may be.
Right, right.
You know their stuff, you know. And then maybe, you know, if you think about people that get good reviews in the classroom, maybe they've just got a great personality, you know, or they've got great stories, or they've got a great wit, or they're very empathetic or kind or sensitive to students, or, you know, are able to give good feedback and have good interpersonal skills. And a lot of that does not translate into the online environment. And here at the University of Memphis, we've gone through a pretty rapid growth of online programs. And I think people are, they here also got a quick stipend to build online courses and get your program online. And now they're coming back after having taught their courses once or twice and saying, you know, just putting my PowerPoints online or a video of me online doesn't seem to be that effective. Do you know why? So it's a great open door. And I hope we as instructional designers don't miss this window of opportunity to basically point out the benefits of instructional design and say there is a field of people that study how to do this effectively, and that's what we do. And so we've tried to take advantage of that.
And to your point, the more we step away from it and pretend that we aren't involved in instruction, it doesn't help our cause, right? We're changing department names and things like that.
Right.
Yeah. So can you walk us through a little bit on the consultancy side, I guess it would be, or could be in the capstone side, how you work with your students in terms of coming up with some type of memorandum of understanding what is required of them, and then also with your clients. So as you're developing the scope of the project, how formal and formalized do you make that process in terms of what your deliverables will be, what your deadlines will be, things like that?
Right. It's fairly informal, and it's different from project to project. And some of this has been, a learning curve for me and for our students. And some of what we're doing, we've had some resistance to what we're doing in terms of university bureaucracy and things like that.
I wanted to talk to you, but make sure we talk about that, because I was curious how this all, especially, do you charge fees at all for your work?
That's a really good question. We try to. But not we're completely nonprofit. We're not taking salaries or anything like that. What the pitch that I've made to people that want to partner with us, and that's the terms that I use. I say you're partnering with us. You're partnering with the university. And by the way, that's appealing to a lot of the organizations and corporations in our area. They want to partner with the university. It's a good thing. And I can make the pitch that you're going to give our students practical experience on a real project. They're going to do a really good job. And we're going to do it at a very low cost to you compared to what it would cost to, doing this with a private firm. And so if we receive any funds, that goes to our graduate assistantships and maybe to, buy a new camera or something like that, some piece [S2]
Right. [S1]
Of equipment or something. Because we really don't have, we don't have fixed costs. But, of course, when we take on a project, it goes through our research support services office as if it was a grant. So it's almost just as if it was a grant from the National Science Foundation or something like that, only it's a whole lot smaller.
Okay, so you do go through some type of qualifying process where someone at the university is involved in. Okay, is that, and what types of things are they looking at in that?
Well, they want to see a scope of work and if it's a contract, they want to see the contract. For instance, we did a project for Cengage, which is the big publisher of textbooks and also ancillary materials that go along with the textbooks, usually a DVD or a CD, the ones that are stuck in the back of the book.
Right.
We have a professor here who is, I think I can say with confidence, he's probably the country's foremost expert, or one of the most foremost experts on post-traumatic stress. Or people in crisis and the counseling effects, the things you do in counseling to help those people. And so he has a really widely used textbook about counseling. And he came to us and said, my publisher wants to do a new edition of the textbook, and I need to produce new ancillary materials. They're actually video case studies to go along with that textbook. And I've kind of done this, with my handheld video camera, and some volunteer students, and I think it can be better. And so we were able to say to him, yes, we can do this better. And we had some students on hand that had a lot of video expertise working at television stations and things like that. So we produced those case study videos for his DVD and packaged the DVD and added some instructional content around it. And but to do that, as far as the contract, the publisher had a standard contract for working with outside vendors. They sent that to our university because I can't sign for anything. It has to go through some, a much higher level administration, at the provost or vice provost level, which in a way is good, because that just keeps things organized. You don't want to have something go wrong. So the publisher sent us this contract, and it's, 10 pages of something, with lots and lots of clauses and so forth. And then our university lawyers then have to get involved, and they say, well, we can't accept this. And so there's a back and forth between those two. Mm-hmm. That actually was fairly involved. And so, and this is really not for a big contract. You know, this is, you know, not six figures. This is right. much smaller. So I'm saying all this to say there's a...
It's not just a matter of opening your doors and saying, come on in.
Yes, yes. And the, I can see the university side of things, too, because they say, well, look, we don't want to tie up our lawyers on this really small contract. We're dealing with, you know, $1 million contracts, $1 million grants and things like that.
Right.
And so it's a bit of a problem. It's made me have to become, to develop some expertise in contracts and the language that is there. And that's not something that I was accustomed to. Yeah. So,
in fact, and we mentioned before we started my consulting skills for instructional designers course that I'm teaching this semester, I started out requiring the students to have a contract. And when I meant contract, I guess I wasn't, as you're saying, thinking originally 6 months ago when I was designing the course, not thinking that as soon as they would present something like this to their client, that all of a sudden, you know, oh, contract has to go to somebody's lawyer. And so we've really reframed it to be a memorandum yes. of understanding. And
yes.
that seems to sell much better on the client side. Now, from my standpoint, I kind of am doing this without, you know, ask for forgiveness, not permission. I mean, everybody knows I'm doing a project-based course, and they know that I'm going out there finding real clients. But we aren't charging anything, and so I'm kind of... assuming I'm okay, I don't think I'm violating anything.
That helps a lot. If there's no money involved, that helps a lot.
Yeah, it helps a lot. And then also, I think as you formalize your studio that and you call it a consultancy, then you're kind of raising the bar a little bit too and getting, as you're saying, good attention, but then with the good attention, you're getting folks paying attention. And what are you doing over there?
So,
So then what do you, in terms of the roles of the students, you've described what the types of work they're doing. In terms of other skills that instructional designers need, which is project management, account management, managing the relationship, how are those types of things? Do you usually have one student in charge of the project, or are you the project manager? How do you work that?
That's a really good question. I have a student who is, she's actually just graduating this semester, who has been our manager of projects. And so okay. I've been the one that's been able to do the initial interface with the client, and, you know, they want to connect with the faculty person. And again, I'm kind of a networker, so I'm out in the community and talking to people. And so a lot of folks know who I am. And so they're comfortable bringing projects to us. And then I've been very fortunate to have students who are who had lots of business experience and are able to interface with the client, kind of like what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes a person will call us, and we have kind of an initial triage that we go through where we say, what are you looking for? And we, you know, take one of our students will take some notes or things like that. And then they'll meet with me, and we'll kind of talk this through, and we'll figure out how many hours this is going to take. Mm-hmm. Because from the university's point of view, if there are funds involved, they want to know what's your hourly rate
right.
for work, you know, and what's your list of services. So we had to come up with something like that. And so then it's incumbent upon me to meet with our student project manager and say, okay, this is how many hours I think this will take, and this is what we can promise to this person. And we do work out, usually it's like an MOU. If it's not... if we don't need this full-blown contract, we can just do a statement of work and say, this is what we're going to do. Then it goes to our university office, and they figure out a budget.
Okay.
And then it goes to the client.
And actually, that's even a skill with the students. I've asked them in the beginning of the semester to estimate exactly what you're saying, what's mm-hmm. it going to take you to get this done. And then it's the last, when they turn in their deliverable, there's then all throughout the semester is supposed to be tallying what it's, their actual work has been, mm-hmm. and then compare mm-hmm. it. And that in and of itself is a huge skill, to be
yes.
able to guesstimate how much time it takes you. And clearly they're students, so they're learning, and there's a learning curve. But there's a huge gap, and they're shocked. Halfway through the semester, they're all going, can I renegotiate my contracts with my clients? I really missed the mark. And I think those, again, kind of getting back to this idea that we can learn a lot in a classroom setting in terms of what instructional designers do, but until you actually get out there, it's some of these things that are hard to do unless you actually do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I completely agree. The nice thing is because we're not some private firm, we're just practicing basically as students within a university. We can say to a potential client, you know, okay, this will take us 10 hours to do this work. Well, if it actually takes us 30 hours, it really doesn't matter on the client's side. You know, we're not raising the bill or anything like that or charging them more. We say, like we said, it would take 10 hours, and so that's what the cost is. It doesn't matter if it took us 100 hours. We got lots of practice, and we got what you're talking about, that eye-opening experience of, wow, it does take a long time to do this development work. And now I learned a little bit more about it, how to estimate what that time is going to be.
Right.
So I still pitch this as a win for the client. You know, we're going to do a great job on your project, and it really doesn't matter how long it takes us. This is what we're going to say how long it takes.
I don't know if you noticed over in the chat room, Shalene Reed is there. She said she graduated from University of Memphis, but not in your program. I don't know if you, so you've got someone from... Someone from your area there that's saying.
Oh, that's nice.
So, in terms of advice to others that are going out to do this, you've had how many years have you been doing this now? You said that since like 2008-ish time frame.
For the studio, since really as far as clients, since about 2009.
So, what would be some words of wisdom, thinking about things that are you love that you are doing, or things that you tried and didn't work out, pitfalls that the people should try to avoid?
If we didn't have to have any funds involved, to me that would be ideal. If we could just say, we're just doing this, we're not trying to recover any costs of grad assistance or equipment, or we also pay indirect costs to the university at a rate of about 40% of whatever we're bringing in. So I should mention that as well, as if it was, you know, a large grant. You know, the university, they call it F&A, it's the indirect costs rate. So almost half of whatever we budget comes to, you know, pay the electric bill and pay for, you know, internet and things like that. So
so you got the space, but then you have to maintain the spaces, basically, right?
The university would like us to bring in funds, you know, and that's the case anywhere. And we've been successful at doing that. In the ideal world, we could just say to our clients, you know, we're just doing this kind of as a free internship for students, and then we wouldn't have to deal with as much in terms of the contract and budgeting and things like that, because that really does consume a lot of time. And so to someone, if you're in the faculty role and you're thinking about doing something like this, you have to figure out, you know, yes, there's obviously a direct benefit to students. And frankly, for us, it's been a drawing card for students wanting to come into our program, because we can say to them, you know, you're going to be working with real clients, and you may be able to leave here saying, yes, I was a consultant to, you know, FedEx or AutoZone or something like that.
Absolutely.
Before you've even graduated. And it's a great, I mean, we've had students in some cases get jobs with the company that they had contracted with. So, you know, the company gets to know them, they see the quality of our students, and they say, oh, by the way, I think we'd like to hire you. You know, you did such a great job on that project. So it's been a real draw for our students. The downside, I think, for the faculty person is it does take a lot of time.
It's not
publishing, frankly. And so if there are two things that a research-oriented university values, it's publishing and money. So at least we're bringing in some funds, so that helps.
So you mentioned that you're moving more and more of your program to online at the beginning. So I'm assuming most of what you're talking about right now involves the face-to-face students. Is that true? Have you done this at all with students that are studying at a distance?
We really haven't much. Our master's is completely online and has been for about 4 years. Interestingly, we're about to take our doctoral degree completely online. It's been partially online, but starting this fall, it's going to be completely online. So we haven't had as many students just in and out of the building as we have in the past. Mm-hmm. The ones that have been here and have been working in the studio have been graduate assistants. So they've had, you know, their tuition covered and a little bit of stipend to work in the studio. And it's going to be an issue going forward because some of those have actually been doctoral students and folks have moved here, you know, to be a part of our program. Well, if they don't have to do that anymore, this comes under the advice column too. That one of the biggest issues we have is turnover. And we're going to have turnover. You know, it's not like we have a set staff besides me. And so if I look at some of the other entities that are kind of like what we're doing here with the studio, there's one at the University of Missouri, there's one at Notre Dame, where they're doing things like this, usually they're with full-time staff people. And the students are helpers. You know what I mean? The students...
They're like employees.
They're not the project managers. Mm-hmm. The center, whatever they're calling it, has full-time paid employees, and then the students are coming along to help. So we're not in the position to do that, and we're really just trying to get our students practical experience. But the issue of turnover is a big problem because, you know, I might have someone, in fact, couple of years ago, I had someone who'd done all this video work for PBS. So I can say, look, we've got great video expertise for video projects that you need. Well, then he graduates. You know, and I come, the next person has, you know, lots of experience with, you know, maybe some particular software tools. And it's hard to make the pitch to a company and say, hey, we'll do your great video project if we can do it right now. You know, right, because right. Next semester I'm going to have a different set of people and different projects. So That really is a challenge.
So what will be your challenge as you have almost nearly everybody interfacing your program as a student from an online or distance perspective? Do you think you're going to be able to continue to do it, or do you think it will just morph into different types of roles where, I don't know, what are you going to do as you get more students?
That's a really good question. I think, and we're wrestling with this in a lot of areas, not just within the studio, but just in terms of our program. How do we beef up our online presence to connect more with students? Because as we've moved to teaching online courses, I personally have lost some of that connection with students in terms of knowing them and their goals and their plans and even like their particular skills, and how they interface with people. You know, all those things that you would need to know as someone, you know, when you're turning them loose to work with real clients. And so that's much harder to do virtually. And so we're trying to figure out how to ramp that up. You know, things like Google Hangouts will be a part of it, I think, in terms of doing some synchronous things. That's interesting. In our courses right now, we don't do many synchronous events, generally speaking. It's almost all asynchronous. And some of that's by policy from the university, and some of it's, I think, by faculty preference. But I think some of that's going to have to change. Yeah. And we're also talking about, do we have some kind of in-person residential experience that students come in for. It's kind of up in the air right now.
And to address these concerns, the class that I'm teaching, we're spread across the country. I'm in Chicago. People are in Virginia, Texas, Maryland, wherever. And so the way I addressed it, our clients aren't coming from our home base in Virginia. They're coming from where the student's actually responsible for getting them, which brings in all the issues you addressed at the beginning. You need to have some real, it just is a long learning curve just to meet people and get yourself out there. And so that is how we came about, that's how we've evolved in the class that I'm doing. But I've also wondered, I'm based here in Chicago, would it work if I went to approach a nonprofit or whatever it might be here in Chicago? They may be interested until I say, oh, by the way, the students you're working with are in Maryland and Texas and Virginia. So because presumably everybody you've been able to say, the people can come and meet you, right? Do the students actually go meet?
That's right. That's right. Even on the project with the other university, it was only about an hour away. So we actually took some field trips. You know, we had an initial meeting in person where everyone sort of got to get comfortable with this idea. And some of that's, I mean, that's a real issue when working with faculty and you talk about their courses. People own those courses, you know, and you say, I'm going to come and coach you. You need to, you know, you kind of need to have a personal connection with that coach.
Right.
So we did go and make a series of field trips. Then we did some intermediate things that were just like Google Hangouts or good old phone calls, you know, and email, of course, and things like that. But then we continued to go and visit the client on occasion. And if any problems came up, you know, it was an in-person visit.
And that really boils down to the account management piece that I was mentioning before. And I was speaking with a professor in North Carolina, and she was saying she is so protective of those relationships that she doesn't really relinquish much of that to her students because, as you're saying, they come and go. If there's a bad experience, now you've burned that bridge and you've lost a great contact for the future. And so those are all things that people have raised is that client relationship is kind of golden once you get it, especially, and I was speaking my first webcast, I was asking my guest what he did to kind of pre-qualify his clients, and he approached them very much like saying, you're an extension of my class, and so you have to view this as you're offering a learning opportunity to my students. And as you're saying, when you kind of went in with the coach idea that that's what they're doing, he felt that was helpful in terms of getting the client prepared for what the relationship was going to look like. Mm-hmm. So yes, they would be getting a deliverable, some type of work product, but at the same time that there's something that was being asked of them from a learning standpoint. And I kind of set the stage for that. So, well, we're kind of running through our minutes here. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that I haven't asked in terms of how the process works or what your role is or your student's role?
I would just say it's been a lot of fun. It has been fun. I think we're, because of the issues that I talked about, the main issues are the bureaucracy within the university, for good or ill, you know, learning how to navigate those pathways. The student turnover, the changes in staff that we have from year to year, that really is a significant issue. And then just relationship with clients and how that, you know, can change according to who you have and what skills you have within a studio.
Right.
If it was ideal, we'd have full-time staff and the students would just be joining in on projects. Mm-hmm. But the upside is the students have gotten to lead projects directly, you know, and so far, you know, things have gone pretty well. So
And like I said, I think those are the skills that are, first of all, hard to teach in a classroom setting and really work better if they can get their hands dirty and give it a try. So before we started recording today, I was mentioning to you that my idea of trying to establish some type of virtual instructional design consultancy mm-hmm. where we use students. So from your perspective, from your university, how would that play is if you took away some of those issues of the contracts and that you're not responsible necessarily for what the relationship is how it's established and what the parameters of the agreements are. Is that something that would be best done on a class-by-class basis, that maybe an internship or a practicum, or how would that play, I guess, in general?
And are you saying if this external sort of virtual consultancy existed and students
exactly.
could sort of build a profile like Match.com like you were talking about or something
exactly.
like that?
Exactly, and that's really my vision. So you'd have a roster of students with a profile. You'd have some folks coming in with an RFP that says this is what I need done, and then through some type of yet-to-be-determined way we'd match them and manage the project through the course of a semester or whatever.
The magic algorithm of, oh, you like walks on the beach. Oh, yeah. So do I. How nice. Let's work on a project together.
Exactly.
I think our students would really be interested in something like that. We tried to do that on a really, really small scale just here within the university to have our students who weren't working in the studio directly but might want to join in on a team or volunteer or work as a kind of a freelancer or a hired gun, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We never really followed through on it. You know, we never really were able to say, okay, here's how you can build your profile. Because we probably needed to build something more than just like a Google Doc or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we needed some way to have this database of people to draw from and the list of skills. And we just weren't on the scale. We didn't have the scale to do it. We didn't have the number of projects coming in and the number of people to really make it practical. But, you know, if it's a nationwide kind of thing, or if it's a virtual thing that anyone could do, you know, I think that's an attractive idea.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at. This is just a side project that I'm working on, and I can come up with 100 reasons why it won't work. A lot of the things you mentioned that are just tough to deal with even in a face-to-face environment, and then you take it virtual and you take it with people you don't know, and 16, I keep coming back to this whole 16-week. It's hard to imagine a huge pool of instructional design projects that can be accomplished within a semester's time frame, which is a huge requirement for our students, obviously. So
that's another issue, too, that we had to kind of educate our clients about, because when we were working with an outside company, I had to also stick in, oh, by the way, these are students, and the reason they didn't finish that project during the summer is they weren't here. They were gone. You know, they took their final exams and then they're gone. And that, in the business world, people are going, what? Spring break, what is that? You know?
Exactly.
So there's definitely a cultural clash that you have to kind of overcome, too.
Right. Well, this is awesome. I really thank you for the short notice. We got you on real quick, and I just love hearing about what you're doing, and I wish you all the luck in the world and keeping it rolling. So you've got right now, how many students are in the studio this semester?
We have five.
Great. Oh, wow. They're getting, like you said, our students are also in my class going through the beginning of the semester, what's required of an instructional designer from skills and experience, and nearly every job request or job posting mm-hmm. says you need experience. And mm-hmm. so it's just a matter of trying to find a way to help them get it, to get those jobs once they graduate. So, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This has been really, really interesting. I like the idea of the of your Match.com example. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, we'll see where it goes, but it's something I've been gnawing on since I started teaching this consulting class, and just thinking there's got to be a way that we can make this happen, and plus leverage all those stuff we've taught. You said you're a big networker, and I think it's a skill students also need, is to be able to work with people across the country and work virtually and work on virtual teams, and I think there's some benefit to that as well. So we'll see where it goes.
Can I give one plug?
Yeah,
I want to plug
something. Yeah, plug.
This semester, our students, I get lots of questions about how do I find a job, what books should I be reading, what journals should I be reading, and how do I find them, what conferences, what organizations should I join, all those kinds of things. And I'm sure you hear those questions too.
Absolutely.
These are common questions from students. So this semester, our students, I was sort of guiding them, we put together lists of all those things. And in some cases, they're lists of lists. And it's on my website. It's on treymartindale.com.
Okay.
If you look on there, there's just a page for how to find a job and what sort of career skills are necessary, what books you should be reading, what organizations there are and how to find them and how to find journals and things like that. And in some cases, I just made lists of lists because there are lots of other people that have made these great lists. So really, we're just pointing them to those great lists. So
this is awesome. So I'm on your website right now. So it's, like you said, treymartindale.com. And where would we go to find it? Which tab?
Do you see that information bar across there? Should just say things like jobs and conferences and organizations and things like that.
So click on jobs?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, perfect. Well, we'll get that in on our website, too, and we'll make sure everybody's... And I'll mention, I've got class tonight with the students, so I'll make sure I throw that in there as well. They're right at the end of the semester, so we have several graduating. I'm sure they'd be very happy to get this information. So, well, thank you again, Trey. I really appreciate it. And come on anytime. Bring your students if you're interested sometime. I just... love to hear their perspective as well.
I think I'm giving you the company line, then you hear from them the real story, you know.
Oh, it really works, right? Well, thank you again, and thanks everybody for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.